From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV-LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the author Evan Fallenberg, whose new book is The Parting Gift, published by The Other Press. Evan Fallenberg is the author of three novels and a translator of Hebrew books, plays, and films. His work has won or been shortlisted for numerous awards, including the American Library Association Barbara Gittings Stonewall Award for Literature, the Edmund White Award for Debut Fiction, and the Penn Translation Prize. He teaches at Bar-Ilan University in Tel Aviv and is faculty co-director of the Vermont College of Fine Arts International MFA in Creative Writing and Literary Translation. Fallenberg is the recipient of residency fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, McDowell Colony, Banff Center for the Arts, Fondation Ledig Rowholt, and Sun Yat-sen University, and is the founder of Arabesque, an arts and residency center in Old Akko, Israel. The Parting Gift is an erotic tale of jealousy, obsession, and revenge. Suffused with the rich flavors and intoxicating scents of Israel's Mediterranean coast, an unnamed narrator writes a letter to an old college friend, Adam, with whom he has been staying since his abrupt return to the States from Israel. Now that the narrator is moving on to a new location, he finally reveals the events that led him to Adam's door, set in motion by a chance encounter with Uzi, a spice merchant whose wares had developed a cult following. From his first meeting with Uzi, the narrator is overwhelmed by an animal attraction that will lead him to derail his life, withdraw from friends, and extend his stay in a small town north of Tel Aviv, as he becomes increasingly entangled in Uzi's life, and by extension the lives of Uzi's ex-wife and children, his passion turns sinister, ultimately threatening all around him. Written in a circuitous style that keeps you guessing until the end, The Parting Gift is a page-turner and a shrewd exploration of the roles men assume, or are forced to assume, as lovers, as fathers, as Israelis, as Palestinians. When I spoke with Evan Fallenberg, I asked him to talk about finding the voice of his unnamed narrator and adopting the structure of a letter to tell his character's story. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Any book has to start with something that's going to do a lot, you know, draw in the reader, but more specifically, set the tone. And in particular, when we're talking about a first-person account, I've never written in the first person before, have never been drawn to that, but this particular narrator was not having it any other way.
Right.
I seem to have no choice. And so he was establishing his voice right from the beginning and his kind of the tone he adopts for talking to Adam.
Yeah.
In a somewhat condescending, know-it-all way, especially when it comes to Adam's relationship with his girlfriend, Beth.
Right, right. It's almost teasing the way he speaks to him.
Yes.
Very taunting.
He taunts him and all the way along. I mean, all through the book, really does.
Yeah. So the book is it's kind of a page-turner, and I don't know... if your other books, I don't know that I would have necessarily described them that way. But was that like, what did you know about this book as you started it?
It was such a bizarre process putting this book together, like nothing I've done before. I walked around with the story in my head for about 18 months before I wrote a single word of it. I didn't jot anything down, and I just kept thinking about the characters and thinking about the story, mainly when I was taking long walks from the house I was living in at the time down to the beach on the Mediterranean, and actually passing by a house that I used as the spice farm. Unfortunately, that place is no longer there. It's been torn down, and a big mansion has been put up in its place.
Oh, wow.
But that was the house I was imagining as I, unfolded these characters and their story. And as for the immediacy, I'm really glad you said that, because so so many times in a novel, you spend so much time setting things up. There's so much exposition, and you know, it's an enormous canvas. And I felt about this particular book that it had to be more like a speeding bullet. As a matter of fact, I sort of picture it in my mind as a train careening down a very narrow tunnel. I didn't want any extra weight to it. I didn't want anything superfluous. It just had to be, in a way, kind of myopic, like going down a tunnel, because we're stuck inside the narrator's head in his vision. And so the story had to hurtle along. And you know, if I've created that in your mind and in other readers' minds, then I'm very pleased.
Now, you must have been pleased too with the I'm trying to remember who wrote the blurb that just said, you know, read this in one sitting.
Yeah. Oh, Andre Aciman. Wow, that was huge.
Yeah, and good advice too, I think.
I'm glad. As a matter of fact, with all the reviews, there's an echo of that. People say it sort of pick it up, you know, sit down and read it through. And I have to say, when my first novel came out and people were saying it's a page turner, I couldn't put it down, I read it in one night or I read it in 2 days or whatever, I remember the feeling then was like when you have spent an entire day on one evening meal. You know, all the shopping, all the prep work, everything that goes into preparing a meal, and then people come in and wolf it down in 15 minutes, and you sort of feel like, well, wait a minute, and then they're, you know, ready for another meal in another few hours. And after a while, I realized, obviously, it's a huge compliment when people tell you they couldn't put it down and they raced through it. But there was something of the, you know, I spent years cooking this book. How did you go through it so quickly?
Yeah. Well, then you have to encourage people to read it again.
Okay. Great idea.
So I want to talk about your unnamed narrator. And I know I already mentioned this, but I want to talk a little more about adopting the structure of a letter to tell his character's story. I thought that did a really interesting thing. And maybe it's just, I don't know if you will recognize this in what I took from it, but I thought writing a letter made him seem so reliable at the very beginning. And I don't know, there was something about that letter that made the story feel very legitimate and, what's the word I'm looking for? Almost like it had some sort of, I'm losing my words. Anyway, you know, it just felt very reliable. And then as the story goes on, even though it stays a letter, I didn't feel his reliability held up under scrutiny. So anyway, I just wanted to know about his voice, about how you found him, and also why you didn't name him. And then I know we already talked a little bit about the letter, but if you can talk a little more about that.
Sure. I think with a letter, what I was looking for was really this narrator was looking to prove the veracity of his story. And what better way is there to do it in such a personal manner? I mean, why would anyone lie to someone in a letter? I could think of a few good reasons, but he certainly, I mean, it's up to the reader to judge, but he probably does do some amount of lying here. And as you say, his reliability, it comes into question. Although, you know, the whole time I was writing this, I was assuming I was writing a reliable narrator who was becoming less and less reliable. I'm not so sure about that anymore, because when you believe in your own story, that doesn't make you unreliable. When there's a difference between the facts in you, but you don't recognize them, then I don't even know what to call that.
Yeah.
So yes, he wrote this in the form of a letter, partly because he wanted to prove the truth of his story to the man he's writing to. I think that what he really wanted out of this was to show he's a certain kind of human being. And what I hope happens is that while he's making his case, the jury, the readers, are coming to maybe some different conclusions. Well, also partly the idea of not using his name. You said, I didn't use his name, and I feel like saying, no, I would have been happy to use his name. He wouldn't use his name. Because while he's telling this story, he's also revealing the terrible things that he's done. And he must be conscious enough about what he's created, what he's cooked up, to acknowledge the fact that he couldn't put his name on this letter, even though Adam, of course, knows exactly what his name is. But he's also worried at the same time that he's simply writing a letter to Adam, at the same time he's creating a document that could be used against him.
Right.
And so he has to be careful of that. And so he's conscious of that. And so there's always a question, too. Is he writing this just for Adam? Is he writing this for a larger public, perhaps? Or at least is aware that it could become something that's read by other people? He's a wily one. He's manipulative. And that's what I think you get as you are taken along the ride with him. I think that the narrator, as he was writing to Adam, I think that what he was basically trying to do was pull him very, very close in a very personal way. And in that close and personal way, he's done two things in equal measure. On the one hand, he's making himself attractive. He is self-described. He's a handsome man, tall. He's a kind of a magnet for people, both his personality and his looks. And so he's pulled the less successful Adam into him. And I feel it as almost like an arm hooked around Adam's neck, pulling him very, very close, so that Adam has no choice but to stand very close to him, smell him, and scent is a very big issue in this book. And at the same time, probably be repulsed by him. And when I realized this twin contradictory nature of repulsion and attraction, I realized that's exactly what I wanted to create in the mind of the reader. And it's not an easy place to bring a reader. It's also not a place that many readers want to go or willing to face. But if they are, then I think they've found the right book for it. And this character and this story.
Right. Well, and he certainly has moments where we're very empathetic toward him. We feel very much his story and what he's going through. And also he shows great kindness at certain moments. So he's a complicated guy, and that's always really fun to read.
Good. I appreciate that, because those are the kind of books I like to read and the kind of books I like to write. Simple, straightforward, black and white characters don't interest me, because I don't know anybody like that. I don't know anybody like that in real life. We're all so complex, and we have our good bits and our bad bits, and it so depends on our circumstances and our moods, what surfaces on any given day at any given time, and those are the kind of characters I like to create.
I want to ask you about the erotic passages. This book is very erotic. It's very graphic in a lot of ways. And I don't remember if you've done that before in your work. And I wondered how that was as you were writing. Did you feel like it was risky? Did you feel concern about it? Or were you just sort of letting go and whatever?
I it felt risky. I felt concern. I felt nauseous about having to do it, but I also knew that if I didn't go all the way with this book, then the whole premise would fall. It would fail.
Yeah.
And I had some very good advice during the period that I was writing. I was at a residency, and the poet and translator Peter Cole was there, and we had talks about the project as I was working on it. And when he heard about it, he said, you should really read Philip Roth's Sabbath Theater.
Oh.
And I did. I hadn't read it before. And I saw exactly what he was telling me. He was telling me, don't hold back. And Philip Roth has gone even, in a way farther than what you're describing. And I felt in good company then. And it enabled me to really occupy that space that I needed to in order to write such a bold book. Mm-hmm. It wasn't comfortable. I didn't always enjoy being in the narrator's head, but it needed to happen. As for the eroticism, it's interesting. I recently, because of a workshop I was giving in Denver on writing sex scenes, I went back to the book and I looked at it specifically all the way through for sex, and I discovered something that surprised me and will probably surprise you. There are only two sex scenes in the book.
Yeah.
Even though it feels like a lot more, and it's because the eroticism is infused all the way through.
Right.
But I only felt the need to write two sex scenes. And I feel very strongly about gratuitous sex. It's dull. It's dull to read. There's no reason for it. When it's just pornographic, when it's just parts of bodies moving together, well, that's all been done. It's all out there. There's nothing interesting about it. It's got to be forwarding the story and our knowledge of the characters. And when I looked back at what I'd done, the first sex scene when the narrator and the character named Uzi meet for the first time is explosive. It's life-changing in a way for both of them, and it needed to be there. And the other scene with one of the Arab Muslim characters had to be there for other social and political reasons.
Right.
And so even though it was very difficult for me, and in a way shocking, and in a way I know a turnoff for some readers, I stand by the decisions I made, and I'm glad I went with them.
Now, when you say it'll be a turnoff for some readers, is that because of the graphic nature or because it's gay sex? And is that, do you think that limits your audience to people who are familiar with that genre already or are just sort of open-minded?
Right. I think both.
Yeah.
You know, some people just don't like too much graphic sex in what they read, and others who could take graphic sex will not appreciate it being between two men. And if there's one thing I want for this book, I have a confession to make. I think I really want this book to be read, let's say, by straight women, if I can put it in that category.
Well, you got one.
Okay. I'm glad for that. Thank you. And because I think what I was really trying to do was say something about power in relationships and intimacy in relationships, and this applies to anyone having a relationship. But the reason I say straight women is that what I'm talking about and what the narrator encounters is something that surprises him.
Yes.
Because he's been having sex with men. Uzi is not his first. The surprise is what it's really like to be living with a man like this and to be the object of his desire when he was more the subject of desire previously. And so he feels that his role in the relationship has shifted, and all kinds of new possibilities and obstacles arise for him.
Yeah.
And I think that this is something a lot more universal. I know it's a lot more universal than just between in relationships between two men. And what's been gratifying for me, you know, the book has only been out for a short while, but I've had those kind of readers come to me and say to me, really tellingly, a woman pulled me aside, a woman I know, and she pulled me aside and she had given me praise in front of other people for the book. And then she pulled me aside and said, "I just have to tell you, you nailed my relationship with my husband, and I don't know how that could be possible, but you really did." And it gave me so much insight, and it also gave me kind of license to address some of the things that are really bothering me. And I just gave her the biggest hug, both, you know, sort of from the sympathy and also in gratitude that
yeah.
she'd really gotten that out of the book, and I can only hope that other readers will feel the same way.
It's interesting, you know, I feel like this book brings to the table the subjects of of men and women, and also people of different backgrounds, Palestinians and Israelis, Arabs, Christians. There are a lot of characters that are in this book, and in a way, we kind of learn about the universal nature of humanity in reading about their differences and reading about the things that they all have in common. I don't know that I'm expressing this very eloquently, but I did feel that in reading this book. I just very much felt like at the beginning, you're categorizing people in certain situations, and then by the end, we see the humanity in all of those people, and we understand them all better.
Well, that's huge, Shayla. What can I say? I mean, that's exactly what I want, because, you know, in Israel, there are, it's so easy to compartmentalize, and we do it all the time.
Right.
The length of a woman's skirt, you can say how religious she is, how observant she is, which kind of head covering that Arab woman, Muslim woman wears opposed to that one means something about the nature of her relationship to her society, to her God or her religion, whatever. There are so many nuances for men and women in the way they dress and act and who they hang around with and where they hang around. And so it's far too easy to compartmentalize and make assumptions. And so if you came into the book and saw some things that looked like stereotypes and then they turned out not to be, I'm really glad for that.
Yeah.
At the same time, this is the first time really, and it's my third novel, that I've dealt with Jews and Arabs who live together in Israel, and including one Arab character who lives in the occupied territories and comes into Israel proper every day for work,
right,
as a day laborer. And, you know, the nuances are so fine between different groups and the different perceptions. And I wanted to touch on that. And at the same time, it's terrifying.
Yeah.
It's a field, you know, wandering into that, you open yourself up to all kinds of criticism. And and I don't consider myself a political person, but it's almost as if when you put a Jew and an Arab into a sentence together, it becomes political. I mean, what verb do you choose? Are they killing each other? Are they making love? Are they doing something in between? Are they just sitting next to one another on a bus? Even that's political,
right.
And filled with all kinds of potential. And a part of me wants to play into that and use it, and a part of it wants to debunk it and say, look, this is a life that we live together in this, you know, one strip of land, and many of us manage it actually quite well, quite well beyond what you see in the news and what you may think about our part of the world. And I live half the week in a completely Arab Muslim town where I'm one of the only Jews, and I have probably the best relationship I've ever had with neighbors in my life. And that wasn't what I set out to show, and that does not come out in the book at all. But in my understanding of Jews and Arabs living in the same land and trying to figure out how to coexist successfully has been enhanced by my living arrangements, and I hope in that sense it comes through in the book. One day I'm going to have to write some nonfiction when I can figure out how to write without lying, but I haven't gotten there yet. So that piece of work is going to have to wait a while.
Yeah. Now there is a section of The Parting Gift that I wanted to read and ask you about, and this is, we're already touching on it. So do you mind if I just read a really quick piece?
With pleasure.
Your main character is thinking about Uzi's politics, which are subtle. He doesn't tend to speak about much, actually, but he doesn't tend to have political conversations. So your narrator wonders what Uzi would be like in an American context, as he puts it. He says, would he refer to Arabs? Would he talk about them like other Israelis I'd met, perceiving Arabs as huge, faceless, hostile population living in our midst? Or would he stand up to such talk, set people straight, risk sounding like a bleeding heart leftist? So that made me wonder how hard it is to speak out against that kind of prejudice in Israel now. And one of my questions was, will you face criticism for speaking up in this way in your book? So you are obviously a little concerned about that. But is it hard? Do these conversations get squelched quickly?
It really depends who your audience is.
Yeah.
But of course, if all you ever want to do is speak to like-minded people, then you're not going to get very far.
Yeah, then you should get on Facebook.
Yeah. I'm not a confrontational person, and actually what I prefer, and I also believe that when you talk to people, changing their minds, coming with an agenda and changing their minds is almost impossible. And I think subtlety is so much more effective. So when I meet people whose opinions are clearly different from mine, I don't try to change them. I don't try to preach to them. I listen. I'm very curious, and I actually like to sort of disarm people. I like to make them feel that they can tell me what they're really thinking, what they really think about Arabs, or they really think about gay people, or whatever. And then I know where I stand with them.
Yeah.
That's the first thing, because until those things come out, then you don't really know, and you're kind of have to guess. So when those things become a little more clear, then I think there's a process. If it's somebody who's in your life and you want to get to know them better and them to know you better, then maybe it's worth the investment of trying to show them something. I mean, one thing that's been extraordinary for me is that this living in the town of Acre, Akko, in the north of Israel,
mm-hmm.
which also figures into the book, this has given me the opportunity because my older son and I have opened the house as a tiny boutique hotel slash artist residency.
I saw that in your bio.
Yeah, it's really an incredible place. And maybe the most incredible thing is the people who come through our house. It's a 300-year-old Ottoman ruin that we restored to its original glory, and it's a really beautiful space. And the people who come to us, you know, I've really begun to feel that if I could march every one of my fellow Israelis through our house, which is called Arabesque, and give them a day or two in the house and meeting our neighbors and wandering around the town, that we could create peace. I know how ridiculous that sounds, and I suppose it is. I guess I have to admit. But what they see when they come to us is something that they didn't expect. And I can't tell you how many people have come through and said, "Wow," some variation on "Wow." I see that it could be different in this country. And that, more than anything, gives me hope. That and my relationship with my neighbors.
So
this has become something very important to me, very central to me. And yet, this is not in the novel. It's only very lightly touched upon as far as the narrator, who has only been in Israel for a matter of months compared to my, 30-something years. So he's only really experiencing, seeing the sides of Jewish-Arab relations from the meager amount of time that he spent in the country and is only beginning to formulate an opinion. But, of course, I did give him some of my perception as far as Uzi is concerned, and I'm glad you read that passage.
Oh, good. Okay. I want to ask you a question about transitions. And in asking you that, I have three different sections of your book that I want to bring up. Hopefully it won't be too much for us to kind of wrap our conversation around. So at one point, you're talking about the narrator's sex life with Uzi. And he says... I never once in all the time we were together refused that man. I could be pissed off or sad or distracted, but no matter what, my body would betray me and cave with his first touch. I never did figure out what the secret was, how he could gain control of me so swiftly and thoroughly. At that time, though, I wasn't questioning it. And that sentence is the one that really kind of popped out at me. At that time, though, I wasn't questioning it. So that felt like an important moment. Then another important moment is this sentence. It was in early August, when the weather turned too sultry and oppressive to get much of anything done, that Rinat, Uzi's eldest, began coming around. So that felt very important. I don't know, something about the way that that was worded. And then finally, there's a change in narrative near the end of the book, and it's very clear, and you even pointed out, your narrator writes, "And in case you have not noticed something else, dear Adam, I'll point it out to you now. My life had taken on a new interiority, which you should see clearly in the change in this narrative," which I thought was so interesting. So what we have there are three different moments that, for me anyway, seemed like things were turning, things were changing, and you were giving us a little bit of a hint about that. And I wondered if we can just talk about that from the perspective of writing and the craft of writing.
Wow, you are such a good reader.
Thank you. I feel like I just asked this huge question.
I just love, I want to say, seeing something new in my book, or maybe re-seeing, revisioning, and certainly with a different perception, because I wouldn't have thought to link up those three bits. But yes, you're absolutely right. They do fit together, and they do signify shifts and changes. And yes, as readers, as writers, we plug in those tiny little clues, those shifts, and we're saying, and you know, actually for me, the most fascinating place in literature, as in life, are those little intersections. When you get somewhere that you didn't exactly know you were going to bisect this new road, it may even just be a pathway, and it's leading off somewhere interesting, and you glance down at the stop sign, all prepared to just cross and keep going on your way, and you look down there and you say, no, that actually looks more interesting. Let's explore.
Uh-huh.
And so I think it's partly that, my fascination with that. But also, as you say, it's a writer's tool. You know, it's how we move along and signify to the reader there is a shift here. We are going off onto a slightly different path here, and pay attention. You know,
yes.
Sometimes to my writing students, I tell a story about how my father used to tell me stories when I was a child, and I have a feeling this will give you a big clue into who I am as an adult. He would say things like, okay, a train leaves Hartford, Connecticut at 6:14 in the morning carrying 67 passengers. It stops at, and he would go along a route, and little Evan would be adding up all the times, how much time was going by and what time it was now and how many passengers had gotten on and how many passengers had gotten off. And I'm sitting there doing all the math and keeping up and everything. And then my father would say, okay, now for the $64,000 question. And I would say, will I really get $64,000 if I answer it? And he'd say, you really get $64,000. And then he would say, what was the conductor's name?
Yeah.
And, you know, I said, Dad, that's not fair. It's 120 passengers, and it's 10:42 in the morning, and we're in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And he'd say, but I didn't ask you that. And I'd say, oh, I don't know. It was Jack. And he'd say, no, it was John, but you were close. And the reason I think of this story is that sometimes writers mislead. I find it with emerging writers a lot, that they put in facts and figures and plot twists that don't lead anywhere. And we can't do that as writers. We can't do that. If you are signaling something to your reader, you've got to follow up on it,
right,
and you've got to keep them on track. So that's that's my payback to my father. I will not ask my reader to name the train conductor. I will lead them down a particular path and throw things at them on the way, but I believe in making good on why I chose to throw those things at them.
Now, to me, that, for my writing style, that the thing that's difficult about that is that I sort of let myself go without knowing where I'm going sometimes. And so then it just makes the revision so cumbersome, because you have to go back and say, no, I went the wrong way and I led the reader in the wrong direction. And do you have a lot of that in your work, or do you tend to?
Revision is so hard. It's so much fun getting the story down on the page,
yeah,
and such hell going back at it 1,000 times to make it right. But I do have something that I'm kind of lucky about, and that's that each time I've started to write a novel, I've had the narrative arc of the entire novel. And so for me, I have a kind of a roadmap that I'm always working from, but I allow myself to deviate as much as necessary. I think that's something I learned with my first novel, where I was very dogged and kept thinking that I had to stay on the path, which made me grossly overwrite. I wrote 180,000 words to come up with a 65,000 word book, which I don't regret a single word that I threw away, because I was teaching myself, you know, how to write a novel. But still, the idea of having a forward thrust, knowing where you're going, and allowing yourself to deviate is much more comfortable for me than just setting out and having no clue really where I'm going. But I have to tell you, I've been canvassing writers for years now on this particular topic, and I'd say that 85 to even 90% of the writers start out pretty blind.
Yeah.
That they know that they have an image, they have some characters they're interested in exploring, they might have heard a line of dialogue in a cafe, and that sends them off and running, and they really don't know where anything is going to end. And I don't write that way. I can't say that I'll continue writing the way I do, but so far, with the three novels I've completed and the one that I'm working on, that's been the case.
Okay, great. That's great. I want to ask you about a couple of books. While I was reading this book, some of these erotic passages about spices and scents and people's scents brought this book to mind. And I was wondering if you ever read Perfume by Patrick Susskind?
Yes, absolutely.
It's a great book. Anyway, I think it's a good book to call to my mind. I thought you did that really well with all the scents and the spices and...
Well, thank you. And I have to say that a number of years ago, I decided I wanted to teach about the importance of the senses, and in particular, scent.
Yeah.
And when I was preparing, I had, you know, some ideas, some notes, whatever. And then I said, well, I'm going to have to find some passages that relate to what I want to prove about the importance of scent. And I stood in front of my bookshelf at home, and I really didn't know, except for Perfume, because it was so obvious that scent was such a theme in that novel. Mm-hmm. I just stood pulling books off the shelf and saying, all right, this is a book I like, this is a book I like. Let's see what was in there about scent. And you know the strangest thing? All four of the books that I pulled, the first four books that I pulled off the shelf, all began with a scent image.
Oh, wow.
It was that prominent. And that important to all of those readers. And I thought, well, I'm really onto something here, and I'm not the only one. We all seem to know this, how important it is. I did some research. There's a wonderful book by Diane Ackerman about writing and the senses. And, I mean, what she writes there about the sense of smell is tremendous. I learned a lot about that and why we as human beings are so connected, why memory and scent are so connected. It's fascinating. So it's definitely something that's hugely important to me in my writing.
Yeah, okay. The other book I was going to ask you about is the Israeli cookbook, Plenty. I wondered if that book, you know, I imagine that book represents a huge sort of culinary tradition in your part of the world, in Israel, that is that here we're mostly looking at Plenty and saying, this is the Israeli cookbook, this is the one. But when I was reading all of your cooking scenes with your narrator, I thought of that book, so I don't know.
Oh, no, I can't claim that. And as a matter of fact, I mean, I get asked about the wonderful meals I must make, and I'm really not much of a cook. I talk about it, I write about it, I eat it, but I really am not much of a cook, less and less the older I get, actually. It's really, I was going to say book knowledge, but it's more than that. It's experiential, but I really didn't use Plenty. It didn't factor into my thought process. What I did use, and I gave an acknowledgement to this, was a book called The Art of Blending by Lior Lev Sirkals, who has a wonderful shop in New York called La Boite. And that cued me into the mixing of spices and how they connect to different foods. And I had great fun with that, as you know from reading the book. It was a great pleasure working with spices.
Yeah, it was so... I wanted cardamom cinnamon rolls so badly.
Yeah. The book can make you hungry. It should,
very
it
much
should come
so.
With a warning.
Definitely. So one thing that I thought The Parting Gift did really well, and I wondered how, let's see, how purposeful this was or how it just happened, is you hint at tragedy early on, and then the book sort of accumulates characters who we care about and we worry about, and we don't really know what the tragedy is that's been hinted at, but we do know that we should be worried. So do you see that as like a tool of suspense that you're knowledgeably wielding?
I think it's buried so deep within that I think it's not so much from knowledge as it is from an intrinsic kind of a feeling. But, you know, so much of writing is like that for me. And I really make the divide between writing and revision, where writing to me is almost unconscious. It comes from a place of emotion and feeling, and then revision moves that writing into the intellect, mm-hmm. so that we have to look back and say, how was I building suspense here? Or what's my character development like here? Or why am I using so much Latinate vocabulary as opposed to Anglo-Saxon vocabulary? The great divide in the English language between those two vocabularies, the first of which is more intellectual and the second of which is more emotional. And I would never advise or do for myself, you know, adopting all of those thinking processes when I'm writing. I mean, what could be worse than thinking about whether I'm choosing a Latinate or an Anglo-Saxon word when I'm trying to get a story down on the page? I would never write anything. But those tools are so necessary when you go back and you're looking at your work and saying, all right, now what do I do with it? And that's why I said to you that it's so painful. Revision is so painful because, as I said, getting the story down on the page is the fun part. It's exciting. It's emotional. It's living with the characters. It's exploring their world. It's getting out of my own head for a while and getting into the heads of other people, never mind that they're products of my imagination. But then revision is figuring out, well, first of all, what is this book really about? Why do I need to tell this particular story? What's with these characters? And then figuring those things out and then going back at the book and making it all line up, and looking at a scene that was such great fun writing and saying, no, but that doesn't fit. It doesn't fit this book. It doesn't fit this story, and it has to go, and that's very painful.
Yeah. I mean, you can always keep them and tell yourself you're going to use them, but you never will.
That's exactly. Well, that's why you keep the file that says, you know, great passages, scenes, dialogues, whatever, for other use. And every, you know what? I have actually had that experience of saving something that I was, it took me so long to excise from my first book till final revisions. And it was very hard for me. And I wound up using it rather crucially in my second novel. Yeah. So there is hope for those stray passages.
Oh, good. All right. Great. I'm wondering if you've read anything lately, Evan, that you would recommend to listeners who are readers?
Yes. The Weight of Ink by Rachel Kadish. What a gorgeous book.
Oh, wow.
If you loved A.S. Byatt's Possession, a book that gripped me for years, I'd say this is in that genre of a kind of a literary mystery, very intelligent, very exciting. It takes place in two time periods, in London in the 1660s and contemporary London.
Oh, wow.
And it's just a fantastic read. I'm also reading right now Andrew Sean Greer's Less.
Oh, I loved that.
newly minted Pulitzer Prize winner, and I think it's fantastic. I'm really enjoying it. As a matter of fact, when you were asking the question about the erotic writing, I was thinking this because I'm reading his book now and thinking, you know, why couldn't I do that? Why couldn't I write a beautiful, intelligent book that doesn't have to be quite so erotic and maybe is more acceptable to a larger audience? But of course, it's a moot question. He wrote a lovely book that I'm appreciating, and I wrote a different kind of book that was the right book for me at the right time to write, and I hope it will be the right book for many people to read.
Yeah, you know the writer Larry Sutton, right? Who
yeah.
taught at Vermont College, right? I just remember being in one of his talks one time, and he said, you have to, whatever you're doing, it has to serve the work. I think the actual talk was about not being in our ego and not thinking about, you know, getting published and then eventually having the adoration of millions of fans and da da da. And he was like, you know, you're not writing for your career. You're not writing for anything but the work. It has to serve the work. And obviously what you've done here serves this book perfectly. So,
thank you. That's it's very important to me. I really do not think of audience at all when I'm writing. It's just whatever has to get out on the page.
Yeah.
I also don't think of family and what they're going to say or friends or any of that. It's all just me and the page. And then later, when it's done, when it's really completed to my satisfaction, then I can step back and look at it and say, all right, how is this thing going to make its way in the world? But by then, I'm not going to make changes in it to make it more palatable. That would be undermining the whole concept, and I have not been willing to do that. So I agree with you.
Yeah, and you know, by then, I mean, obviously you, of course, have the power to do that, but by then it's its own thing. In a way, you know, the you that wrote it is no longer a part of it in the same way. So it would make
more
sense.
That's very true.
Yeah.
And the you and the me that wrote it is actually no longer in the same place.
Yeah.
I find that with each novel, you know, it takes so long to write and then so long to publish that by the time it comes out, I'm in a bit of a different place. And when people talk to you about it, they assume you are right there swimming in the middle of it. And I have to kind of throw myself back in. And it's conversations like these that really help. It really brings me back to that and makes me remember exactly why I wrote what I did.
Yeah. Oh, good. And that actually brings me to my next question, which is, what are you writing now?
Well, I've gone back to a novel that I started before and actually completed before, but not to my satisfaction. Uh-huh. And it has been languishing. And I believe that I know what's wrong with it and what needs to change. What I can't figure out yet, well, two things. One is, whether this means that I need to do a rewrite or basically abandon it and start it all over again. And I know several writers who do that, who put aside, I know, that's exactly the way I feel. You know, just put the whole thing aside and say, right, now I'm going to rewrite this whole thing without even looking at the original, which seems incredibly difficult to me. The other question is when I can do this. My life is so full these days that I don't know exactly when I can do that. And this is the kind of project that will take a block of time. It's not the sort of thing at this stage that I can squeeze into, you know, 4:30 a.m. writing binges till the rest of my day starts. It's got to have clean getaway time, and that's rather hard to find right now. But
yeah.
I will get back to it. It's important to me. And when a book, a story, characters, when they dog you, when they won't let you go, then you know, no matter how long it takes, you're going to go back to them.
Okay, great. This is a question I've never asked anybody before, but it occurred to me that because you are very involved in a number of writing programs, that this is a good question to ask you. I wondered what you think of requiring or requesting trigger warnings in violent or otherwise possibly difficult readings at, you know, like public readings. I know that this is now a common, getting to be a more common thing in the world of writing programs, and I'm just wondering what your opinion is on this.
Yeah, my trigger warning, I mean, look, I have to tell you that sometimes I feel that there's vocabulary that's come into American English that entered the language after I left America in 1985. And so I want to be sure that I'm understanding what you mean by a trigger warning. It means telling people that something difficult is ahead and that maybe you want to excuse yourself? Is that the idea?
Yeah, I guess, and sort of, you know, people who suffer from what they might term as PTSD or you know, some sort of trauma from their past is going to give them a very emotional reaction in hearing something read. I have very complicated feelings about this. There was no such thing when I went to my MFA program, and I feel like it's both probably difficult for people to sit through certain readings, but also I think it kind of stifles the work to preempt your reading with a trigger warning. So I just wondered.
Well, in general, I think there's a kid glove treatment that's come into vogue, really in America. Most of the rest of the world isn't following along, at least not to the same degree. That I think I understand where it comes from. I understand why. It makes a lot of sense, but I think it's also rather dangerous and rather contrary to artistic freedom. And I would preach sensitivity and sympathy. But at the same time, everyone has to understand that difficult things do happen in life, and we have to face them, and we need to talk about them and read about them, as long as they're done in the appropriate way, with the appropriate intention, and in the appropriate environment.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. It just occurred to me that you'd be a good person to talk to about that.
Yeah.
My last question for you, Evan, is, for any advice for listeners who are writers, who about writing honestly about prejudice and perhaps even about a character whose values you do not share.
So I think the key word here is honest. Honestly, that's the kind of writing we should be doing all the time. And when I say honest, I don't mean honest to a truth that happened in the writer's life or the life of anyone he or she knows. It's the truth of the situation and the truth of how a particular character would act in a given situation. So if you're writing a character who has prejudices, and I'd say that's pretty much all of us, then it's really important to get inside those prejudices, understand them. You're not condoning them. You're not giving in to them. You're not advocating for them as a writer, but you're putting them out there. And I think that's so freeing for you as the writer and for the reader, because there are so many things that maybe we're afraid to talk about, that it's and they're really important to talk about. So in my society, you know, the whole perception is the way Jews perceive Arabs and the way Arabs perceive Jews. It's not something that's comfortable for people to talk about, even when they talk to each other, even when they're friends. And so I really actually enjoyed that. I enjoyed being able to put those things down on the page. And if somebody questions me about them and makes assumptions about my own opinions, I'm very comfortable with being able to say, well, these are not my opinions. These are the opinions of this particular character, and I stand behind them because this is who he is, and this is the way I believe he would think. And that's absolutely legitimate, and it's pretty freeing for the writer.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great answer. Thank you for that. Okay, I want to just mention again, the name of the book is The Parting Gift. It's a novel by Evan Fallenberg, published by The Other Press. Evan, it is always such a pleasure to talk books with you because you are so great at giving answers that illuminate the writing process as well as just sort of what your book is doing for the readers. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Shayla. And I'm only as good a responder, as the questions are fantastic. So thank you for those.
Oh, thank you.
You're a terrific reader and a wonderful interviewer. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. That's very nice.
This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with the author, Evan Fallenberg, about his new book, The Parting Gift, published by The Other Press. One of the reviews of Evan's book said that it compels us to confront the parts of ourselves we would rather not look at. This week's Write the Book prompt is to do just that. Write a piece that will compel a reader to confront something that he or she would rather not. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. Have a great week.